Okay, so you already get started? So here we are. This lecture is the review for the midterm exam, and I'm going to review the highlights of the first six chapters. And I'm looking here at the PowerPoint slides for chapter one, and right away it says, what is the economic problem? Now, in one word, what is economics all about?
Scarcity.
That's the word, exactly. Scarcity. Scarcity. The economic problem is that we live in a world of scarce resources, and yet people have unlimited wants and needs. So how do we meet their needs in this world of scarcity? Now, we live in a world of scarce. Now, what does that word scarce mean? Now, in economics, we have very definite definitions. So what is the definite definition of scarce? What does that mean? Because it doesn't mean rare. It doesn't mean hard to come by. What does it mean?
Something that can't go around from zero place.
Yeah, right. There's not enough to go around to everyone who wants it for free. Now, if there's not enough to go around to everyone who wants it for free, then how do we decide in a free market who gets and who doesn't get?
Price.
The price mechanism. So the price mechanism is very important. That solves the problem of who gets and who doesn't get. That's really called the allocation problem. There's not enough for everybody, so these people get and these people don't get. Now, who gets?
People who can afford it and want it.
Right, exactly. Both those things, right? Willing and able. Those who got the money and those who got the want to, they get, and everyone else doesn't get. So we've solved the problem. Now, let me illustrate to you the power of this price mechanism in a free market. Let's say that you were the inventor of the pencil. Now, this is a new invention. No one's ever seen a pencil before. But you get the idea that if you could have this piece of wood, round cylinder piece of wood, and you drill it out and you put a piece of graphite in there, and then you could sharpen one end with a knife, that would make a pretty neat writing tool. How are you going to market this pencil? What technique are you going to use? Well, you could advertise. That's true. And another thing you could do is you could go around to retail stores. You know, talk to the manager and say, hey, you know, I've got this new invention here. I call it a pencil. And do you think you could make some money by selling it? The store owner might look at it and say, you know what, that's a pretty nifty invention you got there. Yeah, I think I could make some money selling this. And I'll order 100 of them. So you go to the next retail store. The same thing. You get orders and you go through it, and then you go back to your place of business and you make up enough pencils to meet this order. Now, what did this first pencil probably look like? I mean, was it yellow and thin and hexagon shaped and with an eraser on one end? I mean, it was probably thick, kind of crude, maybe not painted. Certainly no eraser. That's what people had at that time, and a lot of people would be willing to pay for it. So you brought these pencils here. You made deliveries, and lo and behold, this thing really takes off, and you start to make a whole lot of money. Now, one thing that's going to happen is you
can't keep up with the orders. Let's say the orders come in so fast. So what's going to happen to the price of your pencil in the market? It's going to go up. Now, notice here, is it you that is raising the price of the pencil? Now, it's all these hundreds of retail stores where they're realizing that they just can't keep up with the demand, and therefore they could raise the price and still sell as many pencils as before. And so, see, it's the market, it's the consumer essentially bidding against one another, and they're bidding the price up. Now, as the price goes up, what happens? Three things happen here. One thing happens is that that raise in price conveys information from the consumer to you, the producer. The increase in price says, hey, we want more pencils. And the second thing that see, what I'm explaining here is the price mechanism. The second thing that happens is that the rise in price gives you an incentive to produce more pencils. Because as the price goes up, what's happening to your profits? It goes up. Now, in economics, when we change price, what assumption do we always make? Come on now, when we change price, what assumption do we always make? Every other thing's constant. Everything else remains the same. So if the price of your pencil is going up, but your cost and everything else stays the same, then you know, you're able to make more money, right? So you have an incentive, because you're in business not just to make a profit, but you're in business to maximize your profit, right? You want to make as much money as possible. So you have an incentive to produce more pencils. Now, if people want more pencils, you're going to have to hire more labor, maybe buy more machines, maybe expand your factory. And that all takes money, right? Now, where's all this money going to come from ultimately? From the higher price of the pencil. See how nifty that is? The rise in price gives incentive to the producer to give the consumer what the consumer wants. It tells the producer what the consumer wants, and then it gives an incentive for the producer, and it gives the producer the wherewithal, the money, to give the consumer what the consumer wants. All right, so you're start making some pretty good money. What's going to happen next? Now, we're talking about a free market here. What's going to happen next? What? Well, at this point, we don't have other producers. I mean, you're one step ahead. See, you were the inventor of this pencil, and you're making a lot of money, so what's going to happen? Well, but what's going to happen now? I mean, go along with what you just said. You're talking about other producers. Other people are going to look and say, hey, look at the killing lots of money made in pencils. If I got into that industry, I could partake in some of those profits. So now we got more people entering the market. Now, with more people entering the market, is there a change in the quantity supplied or a change in supply? Supply. See, something now has changed other than price, right? More people have entered the market. That's one of those factors that we talked about that will shift the supply curve. As the number of suppliers in the market increase, there's a tendency for the supply curve to shift to the right, correct? All right. Are they going to look at your pencil and say, we're just going to copy this pencil and sell it and make some money? Or what might they decide to do? Improve upon it. Hey, you know, maybe people would like a thinner pencil. Maybe people would like an eraser on Winan. Maybe people would like different color pencils. And so that's what they do. Now, pretty soon, we've got red pencils and yellow pencils and blue pencils out there in the market. Now, question. Why are most pencils yellow? And the answer is, who knows? But I can tell you why most pencils are yellow. Here's why most pencils are yellow. All right, so we got retail stores. Maybe they got 500 red pencils and 500 blue pencils and 500 yellow pencils. And people come in and buy a pencil, and the store owner says, well, what color? I want a yellow pencil. And, lo and behold, 7 out of 10 people that come in for some reason, and no one knows why, would prefer a yellow pencil. And a yellow pencil sell out real quick, and we have an overabundance of red pencils and blue pencils. And, you know, people come into a store and they say, I want to buy a pencil. And the store owner would say, well, I'm all out of yellow pencils, but I got blue pencils and red pencils. And they say, oh, well, see, I just have my mind set on the yellow pencil. I mean, you know, this is being a little far-fetched, but I'm making a point here. And I noticed that, you know, down the street there's a store that sells yellow pencils. So I think I'll just go down there and buy a pencil from him. Well, the point is that, you know, we can't keep enough yellow pencils on the shelves, and yet we have an abundance of red pencils and blue pencils. Now, what's going to happen to the price of yellow pencils? Come on, we don't have enough. We got a shortage. People coming in, they're saying, hey, I want yellow pencil. We don't have enough. Who's going to get the yellow pencils? Yeah, the highest bidder, right? But we've got abundance of red pencils and blue pencils. And we've got inventory here, and we got money tied up in this inventory. So what's a store owner going to do to get rid of these blue and red pencils?
Lower
the price. Now, is there any difference in cost to the producer of yellow paint or blue paint or red paint? I don't think so. So if you're the producer and you see that the price of yellow pencils are going up and the price of red pencils and blue pencils are going down, what are you going to do?
Make more
yellow pencils, right? See, again, you see what I'm trying to illustrate here is how sensitive the market is to consumer wants. And the advantage to the business owner to give the consumer what the consumer wants. And in this case, what the consumer wants is very, very specific, right? Yellow pencil, as opposed to a red pencil or a blue pencil. It's very specific. Now, of course, as more suppliers enter this market for pencils, as the supply curve shifts to the right, what happens to the market price? Goes down. Supply curve shifts to the right, the market price goes down. Now, notice what's happening here. For almost everyone, this is a win-win situation. See, first of all, consumers get what they want, right? They want yellow pencils, they get a predominance of yellow pencils. And because of the competition, and the shift to the right of the supply curve for pencils, the consumer is able to buy these pencils at a very reasonable price. Right? Now, the producer is also gaining. Well, not all producers. Now, which producers are gaining and which are losing? Well, which producers are they, though? I mean, generally speaking, as a general statement, what? I mean, not all producers are going to. I mean, are all business owners equal?
I mean, are some maybe more sensitive to consumer wants than others? Are some maybe willing to work harder, longer than others? Are some maybe more willing to change than others? Maybe some others are kind of resistant to change because, well, they've just always done it this way and they don't want to do it any different. You see, you know, people are different, right? Entrepreneurs are different. Business owners are different. And so those business owners that are sensitive to consumer wants, they're willing to change. You know, change is painful. And so, you know, there are many examples of businesses that are it's like with the, I was reading once about, you know, one time people bought ice and they had ice boxes. And there'd be an ice man to come around and deliver ice, and you put the ice in your ice box. And there was lots of businesses that, you know, were thriving in this business. But then, of course, electricity came along and refrigeration came along, and people, how many of those ice companies do you think said, hey, we're not in the ice box business, we're in the ice business, and the market has changed, technology has changed, we're growing, and we'll divert our resources into refrigerators. How many of those companies you think did that out of hundreds that were making ice boxes? I don't think there was a one. There might have been one or two, but the article I was reading, very, very few of them, almost all of them, 95% or so, went out of business. Why? Because, well, they were unwilling to change. You know, they were willing to maybe improve the product that they had, but they were unwilling to take a leap and realize that, hey, you know, they weren't in the ice box business; they were in the ice business. So I mean, there's a different mentality here. So that's what I'm talking about with the pencil. You know, those producers that were unwilling to change, well, you know, maybe they lost sales and maybe eventually they went out of business. But those that were sensitive to people's wants, those business owners that were willing to change with the events, that were able to keep their costs low and therefore lower the price, because with competition, what's the name of the game? What did Sam Walton do with Walmart? Now, in a Walmart, I mean, think of Walmart. They don't produce anything. There's no inventions here. There's nothing. I mean, all they do is buy wholesale and sell retail. And they buy wholesale from the same markets that hundreds of thousands of other retailers buy from. So how in the world, what made Walmart so successful? Because Sam Walton was always thinking of, what can I do to lower my costs? What can I do to streamline my business? What can I do to become more efficient? He was always studying the competitors, and he's always studying, experimenting with, where to put the merchandise in the store. And I mean, he was just like, every minute of his waking life, he was always. I read the biography on Sam Walton. It's a fascinating biography. And he was a driven man. I mean, he was just always thinking of, you know, how do I lower my cost? But after he lowered his cost, after he became more efficient, what did he do? Why do you shop at Walmart? He lowered his prices, right? Lower cost, lower prices, increase sales, increase profits. And the competitors that can't keep up go by the wayside. But notice here how good this is for the economy. Now, not everyone wins. There are some people that lose, right? Those businesses that are unable to keep up with this, may go by the wayside. But what happens? Well, you and I gain because we're getting what we want at reasonable prices. Business is gaining because those businesses that are willing to hustle and are sensitive and become more efficient, they're making good profits. And as the price level goes down, what happens to our buying power, generally speaking, as consumers? It goes up. And therefore,
as our real income goes up, we buy more, business sells more, and therefore they want to produce more, and therefore they need more resources. And one of the resources they need more of, you know, what are resources? Land, labor, capital, and then we talked about entrepreneurship, right? So one of those resources is labor. So they need more labor. So what have we got here? Well, we have more jobs being generated. We have a growing economy. Consumers are getting what they want at reasonable prices. And those businesses that should be rewarded are being rewarded. Now, is that a pretty good system? Okay. Now, this is an overview of how a free market works. Now, what we do in this course is that we first analyze how free markets work. Essentially, that's what I just did, I mean, in a very brief way. But can markets, a free market, provide us with everything we want and need? No, it can't. Therefore, we have to modify the market. Now, the first thing we talked about is very basic ways that we modify the market to, in order for us to able to have what we want and need. But later on, we're going to look at more ways that we can modify the market to make it worse off instead of better off. That's also possible. Okay? Don't assume that, you know, any decisions that we make as society or decisions that the government makes, even with good intentions, lead to good results, because they can often lead to bad results. But in what ways, I mean, does this free market system not provide us with what we want? What are some of the weaknesses in a perfectly free market system? But I mean, what are some things that we won't have, at least in all practical purposes, if it weren't for a strong central government? See, remember, a free enterprise system can only prosper in a free market system. And, oh, by the way, there was a thought I had about the price mechanism and all this leading to lower costs, lower prices, increased buying power, economic growth. The point I want to make is, what is the alternative to economic growth? Well, the alternative is that we go backwards. Instead of having more and more as the days go by, we have less and less as the days go by. But can we stand still? Now, why can't we be satisfied with what we've got and stand still economically? Because things deteriorate. Exactly right. We live in a physical world and things deteriorate. And therefore, we either going forward, as with the pencil story, or we go backward and have less and less. I was watching a TV program not too long ago, Science Channel, and it was about what would happen if man, you know, humans disappeared from the earth, and it said, you know, this is what the earth would look like after 50 years. This is what it would look like after 100 years, after 200 years, after 300 years, and you know, it wasn't that long, maybe, you know, a few short 200 years, that there would be no sign of our civilization. I mean, these buildings wouldn't even be here. There would just be vegetation, streams that maybe have been
rerouted filled in would reappear, and there would be trees and there would be vegetation. I mean, even the big buildings in New York City, these big skyscrapers, there'd be no sign of them because things deteriorate. Now, you might say, well, you know, we can go back to the days of Rome, and you know, you can go to Rome in Italy, and there's the Colosseum, and there's you know, in Europe there's these old churches that have been around, you know, for hundreds of years. But one point that this program made is that, you know, we don't build buildings today like the Romans built 2,000 years ago. We build differently. We use different materials. And the way we don't build buildings to last. And so maybe the Colosseum is still standing because of the way it was made. But we don't build buildings that would last more than a couple hundred years if they weren't kept up. And I thought that was really shows my point. I mean, my point is either we're growing or we're dying. Either going forward, and things are getting better and better and better, or things are getting worse and worse and worse. Okay, that's why economic growth is so important. And that's why, by the way, also another idea that I want to emphasize here is that one concept in economics that is so important is the rate of change. You know, for example, if I tell you that the unemployment rate today, I mean, as of last month, it's 8.1% is what it is. How important is that information? Not much. That has no importance whatsoever. Now, when would that 8.1% have an importance? Yeah, previous, right. If we knew what the unemployment rate was the month before, and the month before, and the month before, and then if we looked at these, you know, over several months, maybe even several years, we could say, hey, things are getting better, and this is how quickly they're getting better, at least in terms of employment, right? Or things are getting worse, and this is how quickly they're getting worse. And that's true with every statistic that we come out with. That's why in economics, see, calculus is in higher levels of economics. Calculus is very important because calculus involves two things. It involves the rate of change, and it involves the study of limits. And both are highly important in economics. The rate of change in the margin, that's why marginal analysis is so important in economics, because that goes to explain so much. And the concept of limits, you know, it's like the equilibrium price. The equilibrium price is the price toward which we tend toward. You know, the whole world is made up of multiple equilibriums. You know, we are always tending toward certain points. I mean, there are these natural equilibriums in the world. You know, our bodies contain certain equilibriums, and the science, the world, the physical world, you know, has certain equilibriums, and economics has certain equilibriums. You know, there are certain points, that we're tending toward. So, you know, these two concepts, you know, this is called the principles of economics. Well, those are two highly important principles: the study of the rate of change, and the study of limits. Okay. Well, let me get back to a free market system. If we're basically studying a free market system, but the point here is that a free market system cannot function in it without a strong central government. And some of the things that I was looking at here is one thing would be public goods. A free market. See, what would be a good example we talked about earlier of a public good? Well, one of the best examples I can think of is roads. a road is a public good. A public good is something that once produced, everyone benefits from, and no one is, can be excluded from. And now, if it were not for government and a strong government, and we relied solely on a free market, how would we pay for a roads between Christiansburg and Dublin?
Tolls.
You know, private investors would buy up stretches of land, and then they would build roads on this land, and some would be a mile long, and some would be half a mile, and some might be 2 miles, depending on how much land the investor bought. And then they would build a road. Now, when they put these roads in, if it's not for government, there's no uniformity in these roads. I mean, some would be narrow, some would be wider, some would be dirt, some would be gravel, some would be all asphalt, some would be this, some would be that, and so you drive on a road for a while, and then that investor's road ended, and you get off and pay a toll, and you got another road, and you drive for a while, and you get off and pay a toll, and between Christiansburg and Dublin, there might be 10 to 20 toll roads, and no toll road would be uniform. Now, just think how inefficient that would be. So what is the only way that we can have uniform roads, and the roads are well taken care of, and we can drive for miles and miles, or clear across country and not pay any tolls? Taxes, right? But we need a strong government for taxes. So the government taxes, takes those tax monies, builds these what are called public goods. Now, in this case, which tax pays for our roads? Gas tax. So the more you drive, the more gas you pay, the more tax you pay. Now, that's a pretty fair way in doing it, right? And so, there are other public goods, like public education. I mean, even right here, you went all the way through 12th grade and didn't have to pay tuition. And here in college, you have to pay tuition, but you're not paying your full tuition. A big part of it, about 2/3 of it, is being subsidized by the state. So, otherwise, who would get the higher education, or any education for that matter, if it weren't for government taxing and then putting money into the school system? Well, who would be educated? Who could afford it? Right, you'd have a certain upper class of people, the educated people, and those who could afford it, and they'd be educated, and everyone else would not be educated. And so those that were not educated, they couldn't read or write. I mean, they would be relegated to a very poor lifestyle. But not only that, but if you had a whole, the majority of people not being, educated, and living on a very poor, lifestyle, with such a lack of opportunity, you're opening the door to all kinds of civil unrest, riots. More crime, breakdown of law and order, maybe. You see what I mean? So the point I'm making is that we need government to provide us. I mean, with simple things. I mean, if I say that I bought a gallon of milk, you've got some idea of what a gallon is, right? I mean, in your mind, you kind of picture a gallon of milk or if I say a foot, well, you got some idea of how long a foot is, right? And you can go to California and anywhere in the world, for that matter. Of course, now most of the world's on a metric system. We're one of the few countries in the world, maybe the only one. I don't know of any other one that's not on a metric system, and we're still using pounds and inches. But I mean, there's a uniformity here, right? But in order for us to all agree on these things, how long a foot is and how much a pound weighs, we need government to set the standard. You see what I mean? We need government to provide us with a national defense, for example. You know, we're way beyond the days where a local militia can adequately protect us from foreign enemies, and so we need government for a strong national defense. I mean, there's all kinds of reasons. Now, in each and every case, what do we have to do to the free market to provide us with, for example, a good road system? We had to modify it, right? Okay. We had to modify it. Now, another thing we talked about is an interesting concept is what is the difference between a republic and a democracy? You know, you went back in grade school, you learned the Pledge of Allegiance. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands. Now, what is a republic? It's a legal system based on law, essentially. See, it's got nothing to do with democracy. Like before the Soviet Union collapsed, it was called, the official name of Soviet Union was the USSR, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republic. Well, there's that word republic. Now, was the USSR a democratic entity? No, far from it. It was a command system. It was a dictatorship where power was centralized. So now a republic, our constitution says that we are a democracy in a republic, which means that basically we are a system based on law, but we also have a democracy. So now, who wins in a democracy? Well, who's we? No, not everyone. Who wins in a democracy? We have an election. Who wins? Huh? No, who wins? Huh? The majority wins, right? Right? People vote, and the majority win. That's how democracies work. Now, because we have a democracy, we can influence, we vote, we influence who are our representatives, like in Washington. I mean, this is the way it's supposed to work. And then by us voting, we influence those laws that are made. I think this is a big reason why Obama was elected president. I don't think it was so much that people were in favor of him per se, but they were sick and tired of the present administration and a lot of things that had been going on. And in their eyes, he represented a change. I mean, wasn't that his basic, political message? You vote me, and I'll bring change, and that's what people wanted. I mean, they could see through a lot of what was happening, and they wanted some positive change to take place. So things don't always work out that way, but I mean, that's the way the system of, you got a republic on one hand and a democracy on the other hand isn't a perfect system, but in this very imperfect world, it's the best system we can come up with. All right? Now, what is the danger in a pure democracy? I mean, what is a danger in a democracy? Who could lose in a democracy? The minority, right? The minority. I mean, whatever situation you're talking about, the minority can lose, because in a pure democracy, the majority wins, right?
And the majority can take everything away from the minority if they chose to do so. Now, a big reason why we have a republic is that one of the reasons for many of our laws is to what? Is to protect the minority from the majority. Okay? Now, a situation that we're in today is that there have been, in the past, much support for raising income taxes. I mean, politically, democracy, voting, supporting an increase in income taxes. How come? Come on now. Well, that's the justification, of course. We raise taxes, more tax revenue. We narrow our deficit. They start paying off our national debt. That's the political rationale. But I mean, why would you have support for, I remember when Robert Dole was running for president several years ago as a Republican. He was running against Clinton, and one of his platforms was that he said if you vote for me in your office, I'll decrease everyone's taxes, the income taxes on all brackets, 10%. Well, that hardly made a ripple in his popularity. How come? Well, it wasn't affecting who? No. Come on now. What we're talking about here is the dangers of... here's a republic. Here's a democracy. Now, if the democracy goes like this, we got problems because the majority can take advantage of the minority, right? But of course, this can also be a problem where if we don't have enough, democracy is too weak, then we can have laws passed that really benefit only maybe the selected few. So there's a balance here, and of course, these things don't. The only thing in life we can depend upon is change, right? And so these things are over time, I mean, politically, as events change, this is a flow situation. It goes like this, and it goes like this. But in our system, there's an equilibrium where, one tends toward the other. Now, we're in a situation today where, let's say this is a democracy, and this is a republic. Well, what's happening is that the democracy is becoming more and more dominant. Now, if you're talking about taxes, where's the danger? Come on now. What's the failing of a pure democracy? The majority can take everything away from the minority. Now, why are the majority of voters in favor of raising taxes? The what now? Come on now. This is basic. Exactly. Because our tax system is so progressive that we got the top 5% of all taxpayers pay about 50% of all income taxes. And the bottom 50% pay almost no taxes. In fact, if you look at the population, if you look at those who are eligible to vote, a good portion of those of the under the 50% of people actually get back from the government more than they pay in terms of unemployment benefits or
Social Security, in all kinds of government, programs that transfer money, to through these special programs. So if you've got the majority of people who think that if they vote for higher taxes, they won't pay the higher taxes, those wealthy people will pay the higher taxes, where's the danger in this? What's the danger in a pure democracy? The majority can take advantage of the minority. In this case, the majority are non-taxpayers, but voters, and the minority are the taxpayers. See? Now, if we make it harder and harder on the minority, pass laws and tax them more and put more regulations on them and, make it harder and harder on them, then what are they going to do? What are these minority people going to do? This is what Ayn Rand's book was all about. In the 1950s, Ayn Rand wrote a book called Atlas Shrugged. It became a world bestseller. And in her book, it was about an architect, but the architect was an example of the entrepreneur, and in Greek mythology, who's Atlas? He holds the world in his shoulders. Well, in her book, her analogy was that Atlas was the entrepreneur, and the world was the free market system. Now, if you make it too difficult on the entrepreneur, he could simply shrug his shoulders and say, "Well, the heck with it," because you see, we're talking about a group of people that if they quit what they're doing, they're not going to have to live in tent cities, which, by the way, are becoming quite common in America. You all know that? There are many, many tent cities in every state of the union, and they're increasing by about 50 families a month. That's the present statistic. There are now more and more pictures coming out. It's just like the Hoovervilles of the Great Depression. There are fields, and these people got tents, and these people that 6 months ago were living in, $300,000, $400,000, $500,000 houses and driving, BMWs. And now they've lost everything, and they're living in tents. And this is becoming more commonplace. Now, if we make it difficult, if the majority voters take more and more away from the minority, and those minorities say, "Well, the heck with it," like Atlas shrugs, they're not going to have to live in those tent cities. See what I mean? They've got lots of assets. They're still going to do good. See what I mean? The only reason, if you're worth $1 million. Why, like Bill Gates, wealthiest man on earth. Once he made all that money, why did he continue to work 8-10 hours a day? Because it was fun. See, it's not for money. Money was means, we can buy more things, we can pay off our debts, right? But what does money mean to people like Bill Gates? Now, what does it mean? It means something, otherwise they wouldn't work so hard for it. What does it mean? Yes. It's simply a scorecard in a game being played. If you start the year with $5 million and you end the year with $10 million, hey, you're winning the game. If you start the year with $5 million and end it with $2 million, hey, you're losing the game. But that's okay because, that's what makes the game fun, right? Games aren't fun if you win all the time, right? There's got to be a challenge here. I remember once I saw a movie. Boy, I wish I could remember the name of this movie because I'd love to see it again. But it was about this businessman that became very successful and owned a lot of businesses and had lots of money. And one day, he just quits everything. And he goes to South America. And
and he becomes a part of a tribe. There's a war going on, and you know, one tribe fighting against another tribe, and for some reason, you know, he spends his later years being one of these warriors, and they're fighting, you know, because, well, why would he give up everything and go to South America to live with one of these primitive tribes? It was fun. There was a challenge. So I mean, see, these entrepreneurs don't think, you know, like, you know, most people. And so what I'm saying is that if, you know, that's what can happen with us. I mean, if our tax situation becomes more and more progressive, and we raise taxes more and more on the minority are going to be like Atlas in Ayn Rand's book, and they're just going to say, they're going to shrug their shoulders, and they're going to say, well, the heck with it. Now, unfortunately, they're the ones who generate jobs. They're the ones who own and run businesses. So I mean, there's not a right and wrong here, or really a better and worse, but there is a difference. And the guy that's, you know, the typical wage earner that's, is always lived from payday to payday, and you know, is accustomed to trading hours for dollars, isn't the kind of person, mentally wise, attitudinally wise, that's going to start and build businesses and generate jobs. So I mean, now, here's another caveat for you, and this is another danger that we're coming into. Let's take the banks, for example. There's much talk today of the government nationalizing our banking system. The government has already owns 80% of AIG, which is the largest insurance company in the world. Now, based on what we've been talking about, now we're talking about a free market system. See, what I'm really talking about here is, all right, we're studying a free market system. You know, we talked about demand and supply and all of that, the equilibriums, and we're talking about a free market system, but we're talking about, well, what happens if we modify that system? Now, we did talk about, well, there are certain ways that we can modify it that will bring about good results, like roads or public education or national defense. But what about nationalizing our banking system? See, now that would be modifying a free market system too, right? Now, what is the danger in that? Now, why would that control, government control? Now, again, we're talking about a free market system, right? We're saying, okay, we're not going to let the market determine events. Instead, we're going to have the government making decisions. Now, what's the difference in the results when the market does it and when the government does it? Huh? It could be unfair. In other words, the government now has the power to dictate the winners and the losers, right? I mean, why is it that many states and other businesses are refusing some of this bailout money? It's got strings attached. The government never gives, I mean, if it gives with one hand, it's going to take away with the other. I mean, that's what it did with AIG, you know, the insurance company. I mean, they put about $80-85 billion into it. But they've also gained control and have dictated policy, you see. Now the problem here is that when the government takes control, it's not going to make the... See, the market is unbiased. The market rewards I mean, in a free market, the winners win and the losers lose, and the winners are the ones that were most sensitive, they're willing to work the hardest, they were most efficient, and the losers were the ones that were not as efficient, were not as sensitive, maybe did not work as hard. You see what I mean? But when the government makes the decisions, well, it's not like that at all. You know, they pick the winners and the losers. I mean, it's just like with General Motors and a Ford Motor. I mean, General Motors says, we'll take your bailout money. Ford Motor says, we won't take your bailout money. But with General Motors taking the bailout money, they can lower their prices because, you know, they're being subsidized by the government. So they have advantage over Ford in the market. See what I mean? I mean, they're both American companies. They're both in the same industry. And yet one's favored over the other because one said, yeah, I'll play ball with you. And the other said, no, I won't, because if I do, I don't. By General Motors accepting the money, they were also accepting all these strings attached. They were also agreeing to you know, government interference and government control of a part of their operation. You see what I mean? And so this is the danger. Now, here's another concept. The point here is that you cannot thwart the market. See, the market is king. The market will always, in all circumstances, determine events. Now, how can I say that, you know, after talking about modifying the market and talking about, you know, government control? A good example of this is what happened in the Soviet Union during the 50s and 60s. Back then, you had a command system. And during the 50s, 40s and 50s anyway, you had a command system where the government, in fact, there was a body of government called Gosplan, and Gosplan determined what was going to be produced and what price was going to be charged for everything. Because they said, well, we're not going to let the market do this. The government is going to do this. All right? Now, take anything, food, for example, or any product. For any product, even if you have a 100% command system, there's still demand and supply, right? There's still people that say, hey, I want to buy these things, and there is a supply available for people to buy from, correct? I mean, either that supply comes from the free market or it comes from government, who owns the factories and makes all the decisions, but it's still a supply, right? Now, when you got demand and supply, which you always have, even in a pure command system, what determines the equilibrium price? Now, I'm not talking about the government mandated price. I'm talking about the equilibrium price, which in turn determines, well, in this case, it wouldn't determine the market price because there would be no market price. There would be no market price because the government dictates the price. But there would be an equilibrium price. See, where is the equilibrium price? Where? This is chapter 4. Where is where demand and supply are equal? Where the demand curve intersects with the supply curve. That is where the equilibrium price is at. Now, why is that the equilibrium price? Now, how do we, if equilibrium means a tendency toward, how do we prove that? Come on now. Demand, supply, equilibrium price, where they meet. How do we prove that that's the equilibrium price?
Is it because demand and supply equal each other?
Well, that's one way of explaining it, but there's a better way of explaining it. If the equilibrium price is the price toward which the economy tends, how would you prove that?
Because the price is
higher than the food. Yeah, or lower, right. In other words, you move away from it, right? You move away and then see what happens, right? If you move away and then you witness what happens. Well, in this case, if we go above the equilibrium price, see, as price goes up, what did demanders say to themselves? Well, we don't want as much, right? The quantity demanded goes down. But as the price goes up, what did suppliers say to themselves? Hey, we want to produce more because at these higher prices we can make more money, right? Well, with demanders saying we don't want as much, but suppliers saying we want to supply more, what results?
Surplus.
Now, in a free market, how do we get rid of the surplus? Lower price. Now, let's go the other way. Let's pick a price lower than the equilibrium price. As price goes down, what did demanders say to themselves? Hey, we want more. What did suppliers say to themselves? We want to make less. And therefore, with demanders wanting more, but suppliers supplying less, what results? A shortage. Now, in a free market, how do we decide who gets? The price goes up. People bid against one another, and they bid the price up. And the people who get are the ones that have the money and have the desire, correct? Now, let's go back to the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union says, we want everyone to afford certain products, you know, certain consumer products, like, you know, food and you know, maybe shoes or clothing and, you know, things like that, you know, maybe gasoline. So they set a low price. Now, lower than the equilibrium price. All right? Now, if the price is lower than the equilibrium price, what results? A shortage. Now, in a free market, we already know what would happen. But we don't have a free market here. We don't have a free market. So the government is mandating this lower price. Okay, how do we decide who gets? Now, it's not price, because we've mandated the lower price. Okay, who gets? Well, no, someone's going to get, but there's multiple ways. Like, you're right. I mean, it might be the government decides who gets. It may be those who pay bribes to the government, or those who knew certain officials in the government. You know, it becomes who you know, and you know, it becomes the rule of man as opposed to the rule of law. Or what happened in the Soviet Union is the lower the price was compared to the equilibrium price, the longer the lines got. You know, back in those days, the average Russian citizen spent 5-6 hours a day simply standing in lines. I mean, there was a line for, you'd stand in line to buy bread, and then you'd stand in line to buy milk, and then you'd stand in line to buy eggs. In fact, in those days, people who had older people living in the family that weren't working were considered fortunate, because those people had time to stand in lines. Now, here's the point. Let's talk about the price of anything. Let's talk about the price of shoes. The equilibrium price is, let's say, $25, but the government price is $10. And therefore, you can still buy shoes, but you're going to spend, you know, part of the, how we can decide who gets the shoes is, you know, or, you know, how long one is willing to stand in line. Is that time standing in line not a part of the cost or the price to you as a consumer of buying a shoe. In other words, you're not going to pay $25 for the shoe. You're only going to pay $10 for the shoe, but you're going to have to stand in line for 3 or 4 hours. Now, if you count that 3 or 4 hours as part of the price that you pay for the shoe, then really nothing's changed. I mean, the market still dictates. The only thing we've done here is we've changed the way things look. Instead of the price going up to $25, the lines get longer. So I mean, but the consumer pays the full price. They still pay the full price. Either they pay $25 and no lines, or they pay $10 but spend 3 or 4 hours standing in line. But either way, they're paying the full price. See, that's why I say you cannot thwart the market. You know, even if you have a command system where government dictates, we still pay the full price. How we pay, it's simply different. And another thing about, you know, this is the danger when government takes over, is what I'm saying. See, we're not freeing ourselves from the market, and we're not freeing ourselves from paying for it. Remember in an earlier lecture, I talked about how if we spend a dollar, if the government spends a dollar, in what three ways can it get that dollar? Now, what's the most obvious way? Taxes. If it doesn't tax a dollar, where's the next obvious way that it can get that dollar? Loans. It can borrow that dollar. Now, yeah, and the third way, and there's only three ways here, so these are only three possibilities. And the third way is that if we don't tax it, we don't borrow it, we print it or we create it. And the government can create money. You know, create means to make something from nothing. You know, that word is greatly misused in our society. But, you know, technically the word create means to make something from thin air, from nothing. And we can make money from thin air. Now, all right, the government increases spending by, let's say, $1 billion. It increases our taxes by $1 billion to pay for it. All right, who pays the taxes? Well, that all depends on how the tax laws are written, right? Right? I mean, we can, you know, do that any way we want as, you know, as a government. But however the laws are written, that's what determines who pays, right? All right, so we don't tax, let's say, $1 billion. We borrow $1 billion. Okay, now who pays? And I'm talking about paying here and now, not sometime in the future, but paying here and now. Now who pays? Those who pay interest pays the most. And if we don't borrow the money and create the money, who pays? Now, what causes inflation? Inflation is caused when we increase the money supply more than we increase goods and services, right? So if we create the money and the money supply increases more than goods and services, that's going to bring about inflation. Now, who pays when we have inflation? Those persons on a relatively fixed income. If your income increases with inflation, are you hurt by that inflation? No. But if your income does not keep up with the rise in prices, then you're hurt by that inflation. So notice here that what I'm saying is that when the government spends a dollar, you and I are going to pay for that dollar here and now. How we pay depends. If we raise taxes, certain people pay. If we borrow the money, interest payers pay. And interest earners, by the way, gain. If we create the money, than those on a fixed income pays. See how that works? We've run out of time, haven't we?